back. WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively having a, this is going to be a wise conversation. Oh my God. I'm going to need popcorn and junior mints before this is all over with my friends at Wise Markets. We are also moving the Maryland Crab Cake Tour downtown back to Lexington Market. We'll be at Fadley's on Wednesday morning. Dan Roderick's going to be joining us. We'll be talking about fly fishing, 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock. And also the Maryland Crab Cake Tour will be at Costas this week as well. Don, this is your baby. I mean, these are mutual friends of mine. I don't think they've ever met. I'm not sure if they even know about each other. They both love baseball. They both love music. They both love what you're about to bring in. And as I'm going to a Broadway show to see Dear Evan Hansen on Saturday night, you're bringing in the power of Oscar week. We have Oscars coverage here at Baltimore Positive with real experts.
These are my go-to film people. I'm going to class today. But you know, before we start, it's a little bit of kismet, Max Weiss. Guess what arrived today?
Oh, there it is.
My latest edition. Look at that. On the waterfront, recasting Baltimore's blue-collar coach. I cannot wait.
I love this. You are the best pitch man Baltimore Magazine has.
Well, it's incredible, dude. Tell Teitelbaum I'm sending a bill.
Well, look, not only that, you get this little card that falls all over your family
Those
room.
Are annoying. Sorry.
You have to go pick it up. But here's what I'm struck by before we get into movies. If I were to go to my local Wise Market and pick this up, and we love it when people go to Wise Market, this thing cost me $72 a year.
This is where the pitch begins before the segment begins, and we lose all the audience. Let's talk about movies. They know they can subscribe.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute.
They know they can subscribe.
If I fill this card out, Nestor, I get it for $20, but if I take 2 years' worth, I get it for $15. Come on, folks. Baltimore Magazine. It's an easy choice. There we go. With that, Max Weiss, Alan McCallum. Let's
Don, let me tell you something. I know I am well aware of Max Weiss. I have read her writing. She used to do a radio show that I loved, and I am well aware of her as a critic and some of the personality. So I'm sure she has never heard Alan McCallum. Who is that? His name rhymes. Other than that, I'm very excited and honored to do this today.
Well,
thank you. And great name, by the way. Great radio name.
Hold on, stop with this, man. He knew you were a girl, Max. You know, you don't have to say Max the girl to him. He knew
Max the girl.
By the way, Max, I gotta get before we start. And he's pitching the magazine and all that. You lost points with me last time. I'm wearing my Chick-fil-A shirt today just to make you think about crispy Western fries, because I had some last night. I swear to God, I never eat a Western fry without thinking of you now. And I love them. And I eat them, and I re-crisped them last night. And when I brought them home, and I dipped them in ketchup, and I said, yeah, how can I trust her movie? She doesn't like
Max
Western
and I
fries.
Like the fast fries, man. The fast fries.
Yeah. But you know I love you, Max. You know
crispy that. And Western fries, two words that rarely go together, unfortunately.
Oh, now you cheap shot my clients after we give you a plug.
Let's start. I was thinking
of chicken, man. Yeah, anyway.
So excited to have both of you on. I want to, because you really are my film folks. I mean, you know, when I'm having a thought, I've got to get it off my brain. I got to send it to Max. Alan and I talk films offline. Max, your love of film, where did it start? Where did it come from? When did you first fall in love with films?
I think it was as a kid. And interestingly, it makes sense, my profession, because I think my love of film started with a love of film criticism. So that's partly Siskel and Ebert, right, on TV with the thumbs up, thumbs down. And I loved listening to the way that they would argue and engage and discuss film and the passion with which they discussed films. And then also my parents had their New Yorker subscription, and I would read the blurbs. Pauline Kael, the great female film critic, she really inspired me. So it was this idea that you could think about film in the same way that you think about say, great literature that first drew me in. And then as a kid, I grew up on Long Island, but I would go into Manhattan. I would go to those big like movie palaces in Manhattan, and there was a magic to it. And I just got really swept up by the whole thing.
First movie you saw?
Oh, my
was
God.
That
first movie.
You said the first movie I saw. I will tell you this. One of the early movies that I saw was Animal House. And I was way...
No wonder you're hooked. That's, you know, Spaz was quite an actor. That's all. Alan, what was your, like, Alan and I have loved baseball. So, and Max, I'll give you a little background on Alan. Alan was my baseball reporter beginning in 1995. He's been in my life ever since. My friend Sue Monday, who worked with Don, was my English teacher in 10th grade for To Kill a Mockingbird and Catcher in the Rye, discovered Alan at Oregon Ridge, where they were sort of hanging out, working, listening to the arts and stuff. And Alan, like, is into music and, like, but your movie, Alan and I never talk movies because I never
you don't
seen
watch movies.
I don't watch movies.
Thank you, Alan.
That's correct.
That's why we don't talk movies.
There's a basic, sort of a basic rule that if you want to talk about movies, you have to see one or two movies along the way.
I saw Star Wars, and Alan and I can still talk about that 35 years later.
Alan McCallum, your love of film.
Look, I'm going to be 50 in July. Who are we kidding? It started at 5 years old in 1977 when the Star Destroyer went across the screen in Star Wars. Okay, that's where my love of film began. But then it expanded. I mean, I remember my sister was big into film. I remember in the mid 80s, she brought home Menon of the Spring, which is a French film with Emmanuel Bert. And I didn't know it from anything, but absolutely loved the film, and started watching old movies on Turner Classic Movies. Siskel and Ebert was a huge part of my childhood. And as I got to fall in love with movies, I started wondering, you know, are the things I'm thinking about this the way that critics approach them? So I certainly read and watched and thought about film. Cinematography, I think, it's amazing to see how people shoot films, why they do it. I loved watching the documentaries about Star Wars with Ben Burtt and sound design and how a movie sounds, how it feels. All those things are really, really fascinating to me. And I love good storytelling. And I want to know, I want to see how people bring those stories across. I think my first movie, I think it was Herbie Goes to Monte Carlo.
Jungle Book, so maybe that's why I'm screwed up. You know, I don't know. There was
one of my first movies was as a reward for having my tonsils.
It was
out.
Silent, right, Don?
As a little close. believe it or not, and I can't remember which one, it was a Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis film. But the first real movie experience. And I have no idea what my mother was thinking. I was probably 10 years old. Well, you guys can tell me. What year did Psycho come out? 60?
61, maybe? Yeah.
Yeah. All right, I'm 10 or 11 years old. And for some reason, my mother thought it would be okay for my brother and myself and a couple of cousins to go see Psycho. I was probably afraid to go into the shower for the next 5 years of my life. So at that moment, you know, watching Norman Bates walk up and we turn Mrs. Bates around, those are the memories we all have. But and I promise,
one for you,
folks,
Don. The same year the Muppet movie came out was the same year that the Amityville Horror came out. And I went to see the Muppet movie and my sister went to see the Amityville Horror. And I was jealous. Like, I want to see the Amityville Horror. They're like, you shouldn't do it. Like, I want to see the Amityville Horror. And they took me. And for the next 6 months, I would not go to sleep without my light on in the closet and my mom coming into the room.
Did the walls ever bleed? Or no, that never happened.
I certainly wasn't taking a shower. That's for sure. We're with Max Weiss, Alan McCallum. This is your Academy Award special. We are going to get into a discussion of each of the films because some puzzled me and our guests are going to beat me up as not being a guy who understands anything. But I want to go to 10,000 feet with you guys. I was so excited having you on, thought, let's go to the basics. What makes a great film. Max, you write about them. Alan, you write and think about them. Max, in your mind, when you sit down, what does a film have to be great?
I mean, there's no one thing, right? I mean, the film has to stir me on some level, emotionally, intellectually, visually. And the best films stir you on all those levels, as well as entertaining you, you know? But I tend to, when I review a film, I think about what did the filmmaker set out to do and did they accomplish it, you know? So this is why there's such a wide variety of films and why it's so difficult to compare, you know, a comedy to a drama to a horror film. But basically, it's just, did the film engage me? Did it engage my senses? You know, film is a very visual medium. Was I stirred by the imagery, the ideas, the story? But that's only a small part of it for me. You know, the overall experience, was I transported?
Alan, how about you? What's a great film?
I mean, for me, it starts with storytelling for me, and that can be done, as Max said, visually. It can be done through sound. The Sound of Metal last year, to me, was just riveting in the way it told its story, the expression of story through sound, the loss of it, and what... how that made the main character turn and move in his life, I thought was really interesting. If you look at this year's list of 10, you can sort of see how the people are thinking, right? If you're looking at Dune, you have a big money picture that is done by a well-respected director in a beautiful visual format with fantastic acting. You look at The Power of the Dog, that is a very diverse, divisive film that people are have issue over, but is beautifully shot, is incredibly well acted, and you can't really miss a moment in it and understand where you are at the end. Then you have a film that, like Coda, that is uplifting, family oriented, funny. It's a much more accessible film. So, I mean, they come from different places, but I think ultimately a great film is about what the filmmakers are trying to convey. Do they do that successfully? As Max said, does it engage you visually? And do you walk away? For me, do I walk away actually thinking about the film, thinking about what it meant, what it was trying to say, and if they were successful in doing that.
I think that leads us, before we start taking a look at each of the films, I think that leads us to one of the questions that people often ask, and that is, why is there so often a disconnect between big box office successes, let's say a Spider-Man, and films that end up on a 10 best list? Because I'm sure both of you, like me, have friends say to you all the time, never even heard of that film. I've never even heard of that film. If I had a nickel for every time a friend of mine said, I've never even heard of that film, I'd be a rich man. Why, Max, is there a disconnect between what the public appears to want to see based on their votes being box office receipts, versus what critics put on a list?
I mean, I kind of feel like that's true for virtually every art form, you know, from, you know, literature to fine art to music. There's always going to be the things that are more challenging, that are more rewarding ultimately, but more challenging, that really require some thought. Maybe they require a little bit of previous knowledge of the medium. And then there are things that are sort of instantly accessible and you just can sort of like turn off your brain and enjoy them. And by the way, I love those kinds of films too. I will say that, and we could do a whole show on Marvel and DC Comics. I'm so over that. Like, as a film critic, it's so frustrating to me that it seems like 70% of all major releases right now are either Marvel or DC Comics. That's frustrating.
Are you over it, Max? Max, are you over it? I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm just curious. Are you over it because you feel as if they're mailing it in?
I wouldn't say, well, yes, to a certain extent, they have a formula and they cleave to that formula and they're too big to fail, right? So the films are always a certain level of competence. They're never terrible. There are too many smart people who know what they're doing when they make those films, but they leave me cold. They do not move me in any way. In the beginning, I was sort of amused by them, but now I'm like, enough. But my point was, there's tons of hugely popular films that I have loved over the years. I'm not like some snob where I have to see some highbrow film to enjoy it. I just like the entire panoply. I want it all, basically. And also, whatever you're doing, do it well. But I don't think film is any different from any other medium in terms of there being sort of gradations of what people are interested in consuming.
Can I ask this then, like both of you, Don, how many movies will you see this year? And I don't mean old Turner classics. I mean like new release. How many movies will you see in a given year? New movies.
That's a great, I should have prepared
20,
for that.
30? I don't know. You tell me.
Way past 20.
Max, how many do you see in a year?
I probably see about 120.
Alan, you?
So before the pandemic, I could tell you I would easily go to the movies to see something different once or twice a week.
Right.
Usually so after,
once or twice a week, 75 to 100. That right? What you just said.
And now as we're coming out of it, I still haven't really gone back. I'm sure we'll talk about that at some point, but I'd probably say 75, 80 right now. And that's just waiting for them to hit on demand so I can watch them at home.
Let me ask Max, because the critic and her and wherever the bar is, I mean, Don watches Orioles games. So does Alan. So they, you guys have time to kill that. I just don't, I ain't got.
So does Max.
But Max, Max watches a lot of Orioles too. Max, with you, when you're doing this, because you've done it like professionally, they do it for kicks and giggles. You're doing it like really to have because you're a movie critic. How many of the 125 do you see that if they were a fish or a book, you just would stop in 10 minutes and say, I'm a chapter in, I don't like this, because that I'm a freaking snob. Like I don't have 2 hours to piss away on an awful golf course with people I don't want to golf with or at a baseball game. That's good. Like I really, really at 53 value my time. And my thought would be, cause I saw 100 movies a year in 77, 8, 9, when video came out, my God, 83, 4, 5, 6. I would see 200 movies a year, right? Like, so I've seen a million movies. I literally stopped. And Max, when you're the angst that you had about the Marvels, which I've seen none of those because I don't go to modern movies. I was at an Adam Sandler movie where I got free tickets and I used to take my kids to the movies. I used to give Alan movie tickets when we would get them at the station. And I would see a dozen 15, 20 movies once a month or whatever. And I just got so frustrated when I went to like 8 in a row that really sucked. And I just said, you know what? They're not making good ones anymore. And I swear to God, at this turn of the century, I just stopped because of the wasted time. So the 125 movies.
That was a really intelligent take. They're not making good movies anymore.
No, hold on a second. Max. She'd have the show without you with them. Max, for you, the 125, if there's another 125 you don't see, right? You just say, not going to that one, not doing that, right? What delineates what you might see? And I see two or three movies a year sometimes, and they're usually because you make me go. Like, literally, you make me. You're the only one in the world that makes me go to movies. And I've told you, I'm not kidding you. Neither one of these two, because they're not discerning enough. They see 130 of them, and I just want one that's good.
Well, wait a minute. Before Max answers, wait a minute. Now, you've just challenged me, and I'm gonna say, hold on. I put down, when you say I'm not discerning, now you have motivated me because now I'm going to break them down by year. Every time I watch a film, even if it's a bad one that they threw together on Netflix or Amazon.
See, I can't watch bad. I write don't know how
it
you
down.
Do
wait
bad.
A minute. Wait a minute. You said I'm not discerning. I write it down and I rate it from 1 being low to 4 being high, so that if somebody asks me down the road, I can look and say, and I'm telling you that most films that I watch get from me a 2.5. It's rare that something gets a 3.5.
If I eat a meal that's a 7, I never go back, ever.
Yeah.
But Max, to you, 125 movies, how many of them stunk, and how many of them are life-changing in your way in any given year?
Let's go with 125, which was just a guess. I'm going to say 75, no good. 50, good.
Oh.
25, great.
I agree.
So you see a lot more bad than good. So I'm not nuts in saying that. Like, there are a lot of times you go and you're like, how the hell did this get made? This is terrible.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
When you watch Turner Classic Movies, or you listen to the 80s channel or the 60s channel, or you're watching old TV, people say, oh, they just don't make them like they used to. And you know what? The bad stuff doesn't get shown 50 years later. So your filter is, oh, they don't make them like they used to, but they've always made them. There've always been good films. There've always been bad films, music, TV, but the bad stuff goes away. So
yes,
Nestor, you're probably right. You should probably wait to see things on the greatest hits channels or the movies or whatever, because then you don't have to worry about filtering out all that nonsense. But if
that's what we're doing the show today. Today, I'm trying to get five films from each one of you that maybe I go see, you know?
He is so right. And it's also the same with Saturday Night Live. We're always like, oh my God, it was so much funnier back in the day. No, it's only because the best of the best are the clips that survive. All of the sort of mediocre clips are gone, you know? So, Alan, you absolutely nailed it. They made bad films then. They make bad films now. But I will say there is a difference now, which is that the Marvel and the DC comic is dominating. I mean, you know, you're seeing the films that are upcoming for these studios and for years to come. It's just more of this expanded universe, and they talk about phase, you know, now we're in phase 6 of the Marvel expanded universe, and it's like, oh my God, shoot me now.
We are
you're right.
We are with Alan McCallum. We are talking all things Academy Awards. Well, let's help Nestor figure out on his, because he has limited time, he's a hardworking guy. There are 10 films that are up for Best Picture. We've chit-chatted a little bit. I don't know that I've ever nailed each of you down to which your choice is. I'm down to 3 films, and I'll start, and then you guys can jump in. And it was hard for me to get to 3. So if I'm a member of the Academy and I've got my ballot, I'm down to 3. And my 3 are West Side Story, Belfast, and the biggest surprise of all, because I have some friends who absolutely hate it, is Licorice Pizza. So those are my 3. Max, what are your 3 if you're an Academy voter?
My number 1 would be Power of the Dog. My number 2 is West Side Story. And then my number 3 would be Drive My Car. Oh, but I also
love
Licorice
Pizza. We're coming back to that one. We're coming back to that one.
And we're going to come back to Belfast, my friend.
We'll do both. Alan.
Well, look, since they've expanded to 10 films, I often look at the list as the 5 that are truly worthy and the 5 that they're using to get people excited about film, to make it feel more inclusive. Like King Richard, Coda, Don't Look Up, to me, feel like the films that are either more accessible, feel good, or the kind of film that everybody saw on Netflix, and you think this is a film that stirred people and is worthy.
Everyone told me to see Don't Look Up. Of all these things, I don't know anything about movies, right? I don't know actors. I know nothing. Don't Look Up is something that kept coming back to me to the point where I damn near watched it. I almost watched it because it felt current and whimsical, and it felt like an hour and a half, I'd at least be entertained, even if I didn't like it.
I'm not sure. I love Alan's take. I'm not sure you'd be a big fan. Actually, Alan and Max jump in. Out of the 10, if I were going to recommend one where you sat down and it actually held your interest, I think you might be interested in King Richard. Not only because of the subject matter, but I think Will Smith's performance is actually pretty darn good. No, Alan?
As
a recommendation for Nestor, I'm talking about.
For Nestor, I see why you'd say it. I'd say I think King Richard is probably the film that I think is least worthy on this. I think Will Smith will win for that performance. I don't he wouldn't be my choice, but I think he's going to win for that performance. But I think King Richard was, you know, frankly, the diversity choice and the choice that that speaks, that is an accessible one for a lot of the audience. But yeah, in terms of it being a sports story, something Nestor's familiar with and worthy performances from the actors, I can see why you would say that.
Well, Al, we're not going to
let you off the hook. They're patronizing you. They think you only can watch a sports movie.
See this, Max, this is why I love you. And these guys have been in my life and they're just, they're token friends. They're not real friends. You know what I'm saying? Oh, like,
all right, Alan, we're not letting you off the hook because Max is going to beat me up on Belfast. I'm going to beat her up on Drive My Car and you're going to try to make sense out of it all. What three films are in your final three if you had to pick one for the best picture?
Three is tough. I would definitely, Max will beat me up too, because I think Belfast is a quality movie. I think Drive My Car is definitely on that list for me too. And Power of the Dog, if you ask me from top to bottom, what is the best made film on the list? Power of the Dog is probably it, but it won't, I find it almost impossible to believe it would win because it is a film that is it is probably the least accessible film on the list. It's the most divisive film, in my opinion, on the list. And it's a film about very hard characters to access. And you have to be truly invested. I mean, I saw critics that didn't understand what happened at the end of the film. So, I mean, I, for all that it is, and I think Jane Campion might very well win Best Director. I think it's probably the best made film, but I would not say it is the film that I would choose for winning the Oscar.
It's not a particular, and this is a theme, and this gets me, I really, and I'm not patronizing either one of you. I want you to educate me about Drive My Car. And I'm going to say that a number of these films to me, Nestor, were not easy to watch. And you're going to say, why did you stay with them? And I stay with them because people I respect love them. And if people who are experts in the field say something is really good, I want to like it. The biggest challenge for me for sticking with it was Drive My Car, to the point where about an hour in, I paused it for a moment and I went back and searched some reviews, some additional reviews. And I thought, I've got to look at them. And one of the universal, Max, you may have used it. Cinematic masterpiece. And at the end of 3 hours, I looked at my wife and I said, well, that is 3 hours I will never get
that's what back. I said when I left Billy Madison that night at Cowson Commons, and I never went back. I went over to Melting Pot, and they're not even a sponsor. I don't even like fondue. And I went. That's how bad it was. Maybe Palo's was closed that night with the little sesame sticks.
I want our two esteemed guests and to help our audience, because I have the utmost respect for you guys. What did I miss about Drive My Car?
Or Alan,
why is it a great film? Maybe that'll help.
There's one esteemed critic on this panel, and I lay all difference down to Max. First of all, I watched Drive My Car in 3 1-hour installments because it was hard to find a 3-hour block to watch it. But I was astounded at the end of the film. Look, it's a film.
It's a Japanese film, correct?
Yes.
Okay. I'm looking these up because our audience may or may not be familiar with this. This is not an easy movie to find. I mean, people are like, where can I watch it to some degree?
It's
right?
On HBO Max right now. It's a film. I mean, I guess the premise, without giving too much away, the main character is an actor / director on the Japanese stage. He has a method for how he learns lines and breaks down a story, and he is married and has an interesting relationship with his wife. And the story is basically about coming to terms with certain things about his marriage, the relationships that impact that marriage, and while working in his genre. To me, the film, what makes the film so wonderful is that it's about communication. It's about the things that don't get said with our words. It's about the things that do get said with our words, and the things that get said beyond the words.
That sounds very Japanese to me. I've spent time in Japan.
It's not an American film. I mean, I don't think there's any missing that. There's some cerebral, but not in a way like Power of the Dog, where you can't figure out what's going on in some places unless you're really paying attention. I think the themes that are happening in the film are very human. They use the vehicle of Uncle Vanya, which is a Chekhov play, that to sort of communicate some of those things, which is a fascinating choice. But I think what makes it wonderful is that everybody in the film is responsible for their own situations to one degree or another. They speak to each other in a way where there's no villain, there's no hero. It's just people trying to figure out who they are in their lives and in place in the world, and how it all makes sense, and how they can work together to both accomplish their goals and feel more human when they walk away from things. I would say it is a very Japanese film, but I think it's beautiful in its quiet. I think it's beautiful in its
that's Japanese.
and it's a very tender film that forgives people for their weaknesses and indignities, almost mostly to themselves as opposed to someone else.
Max Weiss, what you say?
Well, I mean, Alan put it perfectly. I couldn't say it any better, especially what he said about communication, because that is what the film is about. It's about the way he communicated with his wife, which was in ways that we in the audience couldn't even see or comprehend. The Uncle Vanya play that they're putting on is a multicultural Uncle Vanya with different languages and even sign language. So it's about the communication of art, and it's about the silent communication between people. And it's also about driving in your car. And it's amazing how few movies have actually been about the very quotidian activity of driving, not a getaway car, not a race car, but just that thing that we're in all the time, that sort of sensory deprivation chamber that is the car. And I've really never seen a film that sort of captures that very uniquely solitary experience of driving a car.
Locke is probably the closest thing I could think of to it.
Yeah, it's a very special film. Don, maybe you were sleepy when you saw it. Give it a second.
No, I wasn't. And just in my defense, I do like foreign films. On any 10 best film list that I ever write down, when you're playing that, write down your Cinema Paradiso is always on my always 10 best list.
Never seen it. Everybody tells me I need to see it.
Oh, I think it's brilliant. I mean, that's just one person, but it wasn't the subtitles. The pace, remember the scene near the very end? And I really do appreciate the way you guys are analyzing that film. But when they're walking up that hill to find her home, which has been destroyed. It seemed to me like it took 20 minutes to walk that hill. I thought that captured the whole film, where it was like walking up the hill, walking up the hill, walking up the hill. And I know that's cinematically beautiful, and I get that. So listen, I appreciate. So
well, you appreciate this, both you baseball fans. He doesn't have wah. That's what it is. He doesn't have it.
I must not.
You say that. You really do spend a lot of time on that hill. But one of the amazing things about the scene, as much time as you've spent with them on it, it's not until the end when they pan out and you see what's beyond the hill.
Correct.
It offers a completely different perspective on what they're seeing, what's happening, and what clearly, without giving too much away, how much has changed since she's left.
I got the cinema. I got the fact that the direction of that scene and the cinematography of that scene was moving. I didn't find the narrative compelling, but that's just me. But Max, you want to beat Alan and me up on Belfast. I remember before. Yeah, I mean, I loved Belfast. And again, Nestor, Belfast is an autobiographical piece.
I'm Googling all of this, man. I host a show for a living. I can talk to anybody.
Growing up in Northern Ireland and the violence between the Catholics and the Protestants in the neighborhood, that film swept me up and it left you cold, Max Weiss. Why is that?
First of all, I want to say Nestor has the fastest Google finger in the Mid-Atlantic, so very impressive.
Film chronicles the life of working-class Ulster Protestant family from the perspective of their 9-year-old son, Buddy, during the Troubles in Belfast. There you go.
There it is.
And with that radio voice, too. Excellent. I found it very antiseptic. You know, it's filmed in black and white, and instead of creating this feeling that we were watching something vintage, you know, it looked so polished and clean and fake. And I just found the whole film to be sort of antiseptic. I thought it was a very sentimental depiction of a childhood. I didn't find the emotions in it real. In a way, it's similar to Cinema Paradiso, which was also a very, very sentimental film. But that film has, you know, gorgeous, big emotions in it. That film, you know, will sweep you away. This film, I just sort of was watching it with a shrug. I actually, when I saw it, it had already gotten like a lot of critical acclaim, and I couldn't wait. And then I'm watching it. I'm like, this is it? I've seen so many.
By the way, Dear Evan Hansen, I'm going to the Real Theater on Saturday. And I know nothing about Dear Evan Hansen. I have not Googled it. But people telling me there is expectation, right? When you send me to a movie, Max, and I really go, like, if I ever see Don't Look Up, I got to write these down. But if I ever see it, there will be a level of expectation that if I'm giving it 2 hours of my time, I'm expecting it not to be a 10, but to be an 8.5, to be something I walk out and recommend. And I think that when you say sentimental, it speaks to Don. Movies are that way, right? Like Don would love anything sentimental because it's the way Don is. Alan, I think you would love anything sort of sci-fi that's well put together because it's where you are, right?
Go ahead, Alan. I'm sorry.
I'm a sci-fi fan. I'm not going to tell anybody. Everyone that knows me knows that. But just because you slap a sci-fi sticker on it, like everything else, there's good sci-fi and there's bad sci-fi. For me, I like films. I believe they're films. I think they're flicks. I think they're franchise pictures. And I think there's room for all of it. Yeah, the franchises are overwhelming this system right now. But the films are out there. You have to look for them. But for me, a film like Belfast, I thought for me, it hit all the sweet spots. I thought it was really well done. I thought it was beautifully shot. I think the performances are great. You know, I went back because Judi Dench was in it. And the first time I was concentrating on the other performances and I thought, you know, she didn't do much. And then I watched it a second time. I was like, wow, how wrong was I?
Well, and I've got to jump because Max nailed it and Nestor picked up on it. And this is why we love arts and cinema and theater. And Nestor, there's no chance that we can oversell Evan Hansen. There's just no chance. Just
all three people on the panel seen Evan Hansen or Alan? Yes or no?
I saw the movie center when I was here and I haven't seen it. No, I haven't seen it yet.
And I saw the movie, not the play.
I've seen it twice.
Is the movie the play the same thing? Not a big fan.
Don't judge it at all. Don't judge it. No. You can't judge it by the movie.
Okay,
the movie
bastard.
The movie screwed it up.
Okay, fair enough. That happens.
Yeah, you can't judge it by the movie.
But the movie's making Max not go to the show.
Yeah. The movie, they're not even the same. You can't judge it by them.
Edie Brown said it was great, and an Edie I trust.
It's spectacular.
See, me too. So we trust the same people. That's important.
Mister, I run a concert hall, right? So a lot of the times when people are going to see shows like Evan Hansen, I'm working shows like Evan Hansen.
Right,
so
right, you're in the back. You're working the board. The Max said something, and I thought, damn it, she just hit it. You picked up on it. We all have sweet spots. Alan used the term sweet spots. There is no doubt that, for better or worse, I don't know what my mother did to me in the crib. I have a sweet spot for sympathetic, touching characters that I care about. I cry every week at This Is Us. It's ridiculous. You would think that after 900 episodes of This Is Us, you'd stop crying. But so that is a sweet spot for me. You know, I always say my guilty pleasure is I even watch, and even write them on my list, I even watch the Hallmark movies at Christmas time. You know, I can take that 90 minutes and watch that Christmas happy ending or Hanukkah happy ending every time. But Max, you wrote about, I was really worried about watching, get your Google finger working, Nestor, Licorice Pizza. Because yeah. My friends are probably as friends that I really respect, that I call my film buddies. They're all over the place on Licorice Pizza. And I said to my wife, whew, I think we're either going to really like this.
Coming of age drama comedy. Paul Thomas Anderson. I've heard of people in this film. This maybe when I was younger, this was something for me.
Well, it felt, and I texted Max yesterday. I don't know if you agreed with my observation or not now, and I didn't say it to you. About 20 minutes in, I said to my wife, ooh, this has a George Lucas American Graffiti feel to it, from the score to the way it was shot. And it had my sweet spot, which is I cared about everyone in the film. And I know that's a Don Mulwer weak spot. It took me forever to watch that damn Succession because Max wouldn't let me let it go. So I finally went back, and she's right. She hooked me on Succession. And even though there's not one admirable character in the damn show, she does have me hooked. But Licorice Pizza had people I cared about. And Max, I loved your description of the female lead. Do you remember what you wrote using the word pathetic?
No. Do you have it in front of you by any chance?
No, I'd have to pull it up again. But it was basically intriguing, conflicted, pathetic.
Oh, I said it's focusing on the sometimes antagonistic, sometimes grudgingly affectionate relationship between an enterprising high school student, Cooper Hoffman, and a smart, sad, restless photographer, Alana Haim, who still lives at home with her family. And
smart,
she's
sad, restless, not pathetic, better. Smart, sad, restless, who still lives at home. I mean, that character, you talk about caring for someone, and again, spoiler alert, Nestor, the ending of that film, you'll say no kidding, now that you've described kind of the ending of that film, for me, it was like, yeah, sorry, to my friends that didn't like it, it worked for me, you know. What's your take on that film, Max?
I absolutely love the film. I think American Graffiti is a good analogy, a little bit of Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Paul Thomas Anderson, his films are a little weirder than American Graffiti. American Graffiti is a very accessible film. His films take all sorts of weird turns. And
I saw Boogie Nights, by the way, and I loved Boogie Nights. So, like, that's how I'm familiar with his – Boogie Nights, to me, is one of the better movies I've seen in the last 20 – I don't see enough to say, but, like, it's a movie I liked.
Boogie Nights is amazing, but if anything, his films have gotten weirder, more eccentric – as he's become more confident as a filmmaker. I mean, he is, to me, maybe the best American filmmaker not named Scorsese or Spielberg. Like, he is way up there. But it's just a film that is so evocative of youth and first love and that period in Hollywood in the 70s. And I love his main character, who's this, like, hustler kid who's got, like, so much confidence. And then this kind of, like, pissed off, you know, younger woman. Her life has not gone the way that she wants, and she sort of grudgingly forms this attachment to him. And you get so invested in their relationship. But it's a wild film. It has all these things, all these set pieces. Like, you know, one minute they're doing car races, one minute he's in jail, one minute he's selling waterbeds. It's filled with all of these unexpected twists and turns. It's so engaging, and it's so great to see a filmmaker who is so gifted at the height of his powers, and he's just in control of the whole thing. And the music is amazing. I mean, the use of Bowie and other, you know, it's just, it's for me, it's why I go to the movies, you know?
It's one of those films. And I do love this. And I call it different than a score, right? In other words, I think of a score as John Williams putting, you know, score.
It's a soundtrack.
It's a soundtrack.
Yeah, goes through that soundtrack. Yeah. But the soundtrack for this, it's one of those ones where in another day, I would have gone right to Sam Goody and picked out the CD. Alan, your take on Licorice Pizza.
I mean, for me, it felt like a combination of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Almost Famous. I felt like there's a lot of Almost Famous in this movie. Paul Thomas Anderson is a freak. I mean, the way he makes films are like few others. And I really liked it. One of the things I asked myself after seeing a film is, who is this film for? I would say that I had a hard time answering the question at the end, who is this film for? The characters are incredibly engaging. I'm slightly in love with Alana Haim right now. Because the way everything about her just sort of makes sense to me in a, I have no idea what she's doing kind of way. And I really like the relationship as illegal as it actually was through most of the film. But it's a series of vignettes that is tied together by the sort of frenetic energy of basically two kids falling in love when they know they can't. And I really enjoyed that, but I did feel a little disengaged from it, just in the sense that I was trying to figure out. Often when the question is, who are they? I can't answer the question, who is this for? I feel like the answer is often is, it's for the director. They're making it as an homage for something that moved them, something about their lives, something they're trying to communicate, not just to the audience, but often to themselves. And that's a very personal, private thing that you can't always get into. So when I recognize that, I try to appreciate it. Everything from the performances to the movement of the film is a lot of fun.
Three thumbs up. Is that correct? All of you have raved about this film.
I gave it on the mower meter. I gave it 3.5 out of 4.
Don and I liked it a little more than Alan, but I think Alan is still recommending it. Is that correct?
You guys agree that he made a choice? Because one of the things I commented to my wife halfway through that really worked for me and I liked it was, and I said, I wonder if that was a conscious choice, that he did not cast either as the male lead or the female lead what I'll call a Brad Pitt, Sandy Bullock type. In other words, movie star looking good kids that exist in people's minds is what high school kid or young. But he cast normal looking people.
I think it was important that he cast people that were not known to us and did not have glorious Hollywood looks, because you needed to identify with them as they moved through these sort of whimsical, random things with people who were often either beautiful or purposely not beautiful. They were a good balance for what was happening around them.
Yeah, I thought that. And of course, the last question on Licorice Pizza.
Cooper Hoffman is Philip Seymour Hoffman's son. Did you know that? So the young man, the lead, is the son of the late, great actor Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Who was in Boogie Nights, by the way.
Who collaborated with Paul Thomas Anderson quite a bit in The Master. So that adds a sort of layer of poignancy. And Alana Haim, she's in a band called Haim. They're an amazing band. I'm actually going to be seeing them in D.C. next month.
You're talking Nestor's language, Max.
Do you know Haim? It's spelled H-A-I-M.
I am aware of the band, but I wasn't aware of her, and I am aware of the movie, and I did see some stuff coming out, but I was not moved to see the movie until this segment. So, Don, you've moved me along. My wife's always looking for a movie. Don't Look Up, you guys know? That was also brought up? No? Everybody's waving that off.
I didn't dislike it. I thought it was – I probably gave it 2 stars on the mower meter if I go back.
Yeah.
I mean, it was fine. I want to – two quick points here, and I know we're running up against it. One, you mentioned Judi Dench in Belfast. I'm going to go back and pick on Max again, and it gets to, unfortunately, the more sentimental piece. I agree with you that I thought she was insignificant until the last scene when she says, and Max is right, it pulls at every one of my heartstrings. She looks at and says, "Don't look back." Well, I was done. You know, I mean, it was like, okay, that's all I needed Judi Dench to say was don't look back. And that moved it up another point on the mower meter. Real quick, it would be unfair of us to leave Licorice Pizza if I didn't ask both of you, what do you make of the dust up about some of the outcry about what they say is the stereotypical use of Asian accents in the film? I've read a couple of things that said that was offensive to folks. What do you make of that?
P.T. Anderson is sort of divorced in a way from some of the zeitgeist of the day, and maybe had he realized how this was going to land with people, he might have left it out. He's kind of one of these artists who's just so in his own mind and so creative. Obviously, the film is not racist. Obviously, he's making a comment about the kind of casual racism that flourished.
Boy, you can't do that in a film. I mean, go check your panties at the door. I mean, like, make a real film. Piss people off. Right. Portray real racism. Yeah, portray real evil. Do that's a friggin' movie. I mean, it's different. Yeah. I can't believe people get upset about that, you know?
Right. People do get upset. Sometimes they don't think about the intent of the director, or they're afraid that it's going to be misunderstood by the audience. But the truth is, the director is not responsible for irresponsible people consuming the film, you know? So I don't really have a problem with it.
Or even responsible for irresponsible performances within what someone might say in a mythical movie, right? How awful someone might be, right?
Yeah.
I think it's
now, Alan, what do you think?
I think it's a society we get caught up in the current day's context. And when you're looking through a filter, either it's something that is commenting on the past or is from the past, it's important to understand what it meant then. And you can't, it's unfair to look at things from a modern day standpoint when they go beyond the realm. If you're a 20-year-old kid and you hear someone, I grew up with the term black as black people. And I had a friend who was significantly older than me who used another word, and it caught me by surprise a few times. But I realized that when she was my age, that was the word, and it was unfair to judge her by the thing, knowing who she was, that it was unfair to judge her by today's standards. So context is important when you're particularly when you're consuming entertainment, music, film, television, and unfair to judge it by the things that are happening in 2022.
All right, I want to reset. Max Weiss is here from Baltimore Magazine, Alan McCallum, my longtime baseball insider, of course, Don Mohler. We're doing movies, we're doing Oscars. I've written all this down, and because I'm like the host and in charge of all this, West Side Story. I've seen the show on both sides of the water. Yeah. I've seen the movie a million times. My wife, however, who turns 50 in a couple of months, has never seen any of it. Not really familiar other than the song, couple soundtrack songs, and Jets and Sharks is sort of a... So when the stage show was on, like NBC Live or whatever was going on, they did the actual film on some channel back when I had cable TV 3 months ago. And my wife watched the first 12 minutes of the 1965 Rita Moreno, you know, like all that, and just said, this sucks. She didn't want to watch the show, the movie. She just fell out at how hokey musicals made to television in the 60s, probably like your son, Don, just fell out. How is this West Side Story? Because all three of you have referenced it. It will be a point of reference on Sunday night, obviously, right? And most of us are familiar with some facet of the old movie or the stage production, or we're in the stage production at Dundalk High at some point. Max, start with you on West Side Story, because I know you have a basis of all of it.
Yeah. I think the movie is brilliant. I think it is so thrillingly cinematic, the way that he directed it, that if you can't get charged up by seeing just all these swirling kinetic bodies in the streets of New York dancing and singing, well, then you and I don't appreciate film in the same way. That being said, there are some people where musicals are just non-starters. They're just like, people don't do that. They don't sing and dance in the middle of the street. I mean, it's like, I don't get how you can watch a Marvel film and that's A-okay. But people dancing and singing in the street, you know, that's when you draw the line.
Max, my favorite. I got to stop you. Because my favorite example of that, and Alan, you'll remember, and Nestor, I hadn't thought about it till Max just said that. My wife and I still laugh about it. We're in the theater watching The Natural with Robert Redford. And when he hits the home run with the bat at the end and everything explodes and the bat, and he's running around, the gentleman behind me turns to his wife and says, Well, that's ridiculous. That could never happen. I almost fell on the floor. The guy was disappointed in the whole film because that Wonder Boy bat could never hit that home run, and he was done with that film.
Well, you lost me at that point, right? You lost reality. You pulled the string on the parachute and took me out of the movie. Kind of.
I said to his wife, "That's ridiculous."
You know when the bookie strikes out, right?
Right, he strikes out in the book.
So,
Guy would have liked that. Anything else on West Side, Max?
Yeah, just real quick. I mean, when you're talking about one of the greatest composers of all time, you know, American composers, Leonard Bernstein, one of the great choreographers, Jerome Robbins, one of our greatest living directors, full stop, Steven Spielberg. It's written by the great playwright, Tony Kushner. I mean, come on.
Wait a minute, don't forget lyrics. Lyrics by
Steven Sondheim.
I mean, this is the height. This is the peak of American excellence. You know, I mean, I love it.
Alan, send in the clowns on Sondheim, or are you on this? Are you into West Side here?
One of the great honors of my life was walking Steven Sondheim through Strathmore for an hour about 10 or 12 years ago.
Wow.
He is my favorite Broadway figure. One of the first things I remember watching West Side Story as a kid on TV with my mom and my sister, and being riveted. Look, this is it's a fantastic film. It's a fantastic remake. It's for me, it's very hard to divorce myself from the original. That said,
orchestra.
The first two-thirds of this film, I think, are absolutely amazing. I think the extra context he gives to what's happening in the community, who Riff is, who Tony is, and why their lives are the way they are, I think gives a tremendous amount of weight to the story. I thought the last act fell off a little bit. I thought it was a little rushed. And I thought that, I thought some of the choices that in terms of changes, like, putting I Feel Pretty after the rumble made no sense to me. It's a song that you have to enjoy. You want to enjoy it with unbridled excitement. And right after the people are dead, it drops what that song can be. Things along those lines I had problems with in the last act, but it was as good a reinterpretation of the film as you could ask for. And some of the shots are just apt. When they are coming to the rumble in the salt space, and you get that overhead shot of the shadows coming together. I mean, I went back and watched that like three times because it was just unbelievable.
Max, they're not going to remake Animal House, I don't think, right?
And the party, the mixer, that one shot when they're like busting into the party. I mean, that is incredible. Spielberg is just the man.
No, there are Spielberg moments in this. You mentioned the I Feel Pretty that, you know, a lot of folks read in the wake of Sondheim's death, because I'm with you, Alan. He's just one of my heroes. I can't. You and I are going to talk later about you walking him down to the show. But Sondheim often had talked about how the song that he regretted the most was I Feel Pretty. And I thought that Spielberg taking it and making it sort of spoofy was crit. And Sondheim actually reacted that he thought the way Spielberg played that was, as opposed to her legitimately being I Feel Pretty, was that it was sort of this take again, the class wars to me sort of came through for that. But I think I've said to both of you, the moment in that film for me, again, Max nailed it earlier, it's that part of Don Mulwer that he wears on his sleeve. Rita Moreno singing somewhere in a totally different context. I just thought, drop the mic, Spielberg. We're done. But the last point, before we let you get out of here, I've watched it twice. And Alan, I think I did say this to you the other day. I watched it. It was the first film. We bucked up and we went back to the multiplex and thought, are we going to be okay? And because there was never a week pre-pandemic that we didn't go to multiplex. Never a week. I mean, we went at least once a week. And we felt safe and I was overwhelmed by the film. So it comes out on demand now, and I watched it again, and it was still terrific, but I wasn't overwhelmed. And I thought, there's a film, there's an example where our being in the multiplex and having that choreography that Max alludes to and those shots that you're talking about, Alan, the overhead shots, really work on that panoramic screen that I lost a little bit on the small screen. So my question for both of you is, have you masked up and ventured back?
Oh, I have. A bunch of times.
Does it feel good to be back, Max?
I agree with you about West Side Story. That is a film to see in the theater. I mean, that's part of what I love about it so much. That is a movie. You know, when I talk about film being a visual medium, there you go. Watch West Side Story. But yeah, no, I've gone back to the theater a bunch of times and I've worn a mask the whole time. I'm almost at the point now where if the theater is not too crowded, I might take my mask off so I can eat my beloved popcorn. Right. I miss my popcorn.
Now, Alan, you're not there yet, right?
So for me, look, I'm the theater manager at the Kennedy Center Concert Hall. Three or four times a week, I have anywhere from 15 to 2,000 people walking past me. On a good week, it's like 20,000 people. For me, that's enough risk. But before that, I was at the movie. I went to the movies because I understand the difference between seeing something on TV and seeing something in the movies. It's just different. But in January, I bought a 120-inch screen. And I bought a 4K projector and I recently installed a home theater system that is.
I'm coming over to your house and watching Animal House is what we're going
to do. There it is.
It's like, I want to go to the movies, and until I feel good going to the movies, I'm still going to go to the movies. So when I'm talking about the cinematography, when I'm talking about the shots, I feel comfortable in saying, you know, it's not IMAX, but I'm getting the movie experience in my home right now. Because you can't watch, we even talked about the Tragedy of Macbeth. You can't watch the Tragedy of Macbeth on a 40-inch screen and feel like you've seen how the shadows play and how people come out of the mist like they do on the big screen. It's just absolutely unbelievable. And
Denzel can win, right? I mean, I love that film as well.
I think Denzel can win. I mean, he can win. I felt like he was doing Training Day in Iambic Pentameter. Still really good. But I think Will Smith is going to win. For me, I think Andrew Garfield just blew his heart out in Tick, Tick, Boom. And I think Javier Bardem is a close second. But I think they're going to give it to Will Smith for a lot of reasons. But the film, I mean, it is a visual experience watching the Tragedy of Macbeth that I can't even begin. And I think her name is Catherine Hunter, who was not nominated for Best Supporting Actress, but she plays the witches and the old man in that film. And I mean, she's on screen for probably 8 to 10 minutes, and she does things in that film that I think are absolutely riveting. And I can't believe she didn't get nominated, but it's unbelievable.
How did Brad? We could talk. We got to stop.
We got to go. We got to wrap this up, man. We got to let people get out of here.
I know. They've been great with their time. I'm going to come back and rant another day that Bradley Cooper not being nominated for Nightmare Alley. I thought that was.
Let's see here. In an hour, Max Weiss and Alan McCallum and Don Mueller, we've done Power of the Dog, West Side Story, Drive My Car, Don't Look Up, King Richard, Licorice Pizza, and Belfast. How about that? And Animal House.
Not bad.
A little boogie.
Not bad.
And Animal House. Pretty good. Hey. It doesn't get any better. March 27th, Nestor, Academy Awards.
All right. Love you guys. Appreciate you, man. And if I go to a movie, I'll text you both first. And if I go to a movie, I think it's Licorice Pizza for me. That's what I've learned here.
Sounds good. Thanks, guys. It was
appreciate
great
you.
Great everybody.
And Baltimore Magazine, available. Get it now. Get ahead of time. Get the subscription. Hold it up, Max. There you go. Yell at everybody.
What Don said.
There it is. On the waterfront there. That's another good movie there. Don Mueller, Max Weiss, Alan McCallum, I'm Nestor. We are BaltimorePositive.com.